Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Radio Havana Cuba, and NHK Japan. We will begin with France 24. Some weeks it seems to me that the best approach to this show is to play press reviews to give a sense of international response to current affairs. So we're going to start off with 7 press reviews, beginning with the South American press on the kidnapping of President Maduro by the U.S. military. A mysterious trader made a small fortune betting on the timing of the kidnapping of Maduro. How was the 5th anniversary of the Capitol riots reported in the U.S. press and the White House website? The murder of Renee Nicole Good by an ICE agent in Minnesota has received global news coverage. European leaders are responding to Trump's stated intent to annex Greenland. France 24 put together a remarkable hour-long special on the kidnapping of Maduro. Here is one brief section, comments by Gabriel Hetland, a professor at the University of Albany, on how Cuba is being affected by the U.S. seizure of Venezuelan oil. France 24.
Emily, we're going to talk more about that abduction of Nicolas Maduro. It's obviously sent shockwaves through the press. What are the South American papers saying?
Well, the South American papers are obviously full of this news, but let's start in Venezuela with Venezuela news. This is the front page of their website today. It talks about Delcy Rodriguez, the now Venezuelan interim president, and discusses her first meeting with her ministers. It cites her as saying that her priority is to establish balanced and respectful relationship between Venezuela and the U.S. Meanwhile, El Nacional is also obviously covering this story here with a very different take. It calls on the Venezuelan people to resist American interference and compares Maduro's Venezuela to Charles de Gaulle's France. Finally, from Venezuela, opposition paper Tal Cual here is citing Edmundo González, one of the candidates in the 2024 presidential elections. He urges the government to release political opponents, which he calls the regime's hostages.
Maduro's exfiltration, though, is mainly being condemned by South America.
Yes, so let's have a look at papers in South America in general, starting here with in Colombia, with El Espectador, it says that Trump is not Venezuela's savior. It says, quote, showing off strength is easy, but rebuilding a country requires much more than a superhero story. Let's have a look at this Brazilian paper here, Folha de São Paulo. It says that this intervention looks a lot like the Iraq disaster. And finally, let's go to Cuba with the daily paper Granma here. It's it pays tribute to the Cuban fighters who died to defend Maduro and condemns the cowardly attack of the U.S. against their sister nation.
A mysterious trader made a very lucrative bet on Maduro's capture, suspiciously just a few days before his actual taking.
Exactly. Suspiciously suspicious, maybe too suspicious. A mysterious trader made a very lucrative bet, as the Wall Street Journal reports, on Maduro's capture just a few days before he was actually captured. Now, the Wall Street Journal reports that less than 5 hours, actually, before Maduro was ousted, this unknown trader doubled down on bets on the platform Polymarket. Now, Polymarket is a prediction platform using cryptocurrency and Bitcoin that allows people to bet on any kind of future event, from the World Cup to your favorite TV character being killed off. The trader pocketed more than $400,000. That's a 12-fold return on an investment that didn't really seem likely from the beginning, unless, of course, you had some previous knowledge about it happening. It's why many people are crying now foul and saying it's, it reeks of insider trading. Futurism, this website here, says goes a step further, saying there's compelling evidence that someone connected to the Donald Trump administration is behind that winning bet. They don't offer any proof, though, in this article, but they do surmise that it could have been an insider at a New York or Washington newsroom, or an operative inside the Donald Trump administration, or maybe even, it says jokingly, Pete Hegseth trying to make some beer money on the side.
Now moving to the United States, and yesterday marked 5 years since the Capitol riots, when those who believe Joe Biden had stolen the election stormed Congress in a violent protest. How did that date get reported, Antonia?
Well, I'll start by showing you a piece in the New York Times that has the headline, "Disgust over the January 6th is no longer partisan." You can see that image of a sort of reddened image of the Capitol building. Now, the article describes those riots as an event no one could have imagined 5 years ago, but heralding an era that hasn't yet ended. They say it was a turning point towards an even more lawless, in the words of the article, version of Donald Trump. And the article goes on to look back over those riots, the violence, the police beaten with their own batons, officers inhaling pepper spray into the lungs, and officers committing suicide in the weeks and months that followed. That's in stark contrast with the account that was published on the White House's own website yesterday. Rather an alarming post in its content, recasting those riots as a peaceful protest. This post says that the Democrats were the real insurrectionists that day for certifying the Biden victory, and that the rioters were mere trespassers, denied due process in subsequent legal proceedings, and imprisoned as political hostages by what they described as a weaponized Department of Justice under Joe Biden. The Wall Street Journal responds to that post on the White House website, describing a Democratic attempt yesterday in Senate to pass a resolution, what was supposed to be a bipartisan resolution, characterizing those riots as an assault on democracy, a resolution that was blocked by Republican lawmakers, something Nancy Pelosi described as an attempt to rewrite history.
In our press review now, we're going to get a bit more on our top story, the death of a 37-year-old woman at the hands of an ICE agent, garnering a lot of reactions in the press. Diptyque Long, you're here to bring us, take us all through it.
Yeah, that's right, Karis. Let's show you the front of the Globe and Mail, the Canadian Daily today, actually headlining on this with a front page picture, "Killing Royals, Minneapolis," it says on its front page. It's also dominating the local paper in Minneapolis, the Minnesota Star Tribune here. It reports that thousands of people gathered to memorialize a woman who was killed by ICE agents on Wednesday. Her name was Renee Nicole Good. She was a 37-year-old woman and mother of a 6-year-old child.
All right, so what reactions are we seeing then in the opinion pages?
Well, her death came amidst anti-ICE protests in the city, and there's quite a few opinion pages. This is from opinion articles. This is from Phil Morris, a columnist for the Minnesota Star Tribune, who says that he calls her death, quote, "tragically predictable," accusing the federal government of turning Minnesota into a testing ground for the most aggressive street-level immigration enforcement yet deployed. Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem, like ICE, has said that it was self-defense, that Good was attempting to run over ICE agents and ram them with her vehicle, which is why they had to defend themselves and fire upon her. In another opinion piece from the Minnesota Star Tribune, this is Jennifer Brooks, who says that her killing and the aftermath, with the vigils being held in her honor, also are a painful reminder of 2020, because it was also in Minneapolis that George Floyd was killed by a police officer, and his death, of course, sparked nationwide protests against racially motivated police brutality. It's not quite the same thing, but the sentiment is still very much there, and there is
a sense of pain in the city is what she argues.
All right, well, Denmark is seething as Donald Trump mulls acquiring Greenland. Tensions, though, are also mounting between Trump and European leaders.
Well, we've been talking a lot about it in the press review this week. Where is Europe in all of this? How are they reacting? It appears that they were quite muted in the beginning, but they're scrambling to respond. A few days ago, several leaders issued a statement defending Denmark's sovereignty over Greenland. This writer for the Christian Science Monitor here looks at exactly what Europe can do to stop this. And the reality is there is very little Europe can do to stop the U.S. in its pursuit of Greenland other than using diplomacy. Politico, however, does offer some different options. It outlines today what Europe could do to mitigate this situation. It could, option number one, find a compromise, a negotiated settlement that would give Donald Trump the win he wants while allowing Denmark and Greenland to save face. Option two, giving Greenland a ton of cash. Option three, it says, boots on the ground. And option four is maybe the one trick that Europe still has left to play, or a trick up its sleeve. It's called the anti-coercion instrument. It would allow the EU to retaliate by creating penalties against any country using coercion against it.
Here again from Gabrielle Hetland, author of Democracy on the Ground, Local Politics in Latin America's Left Turn. Because I want to talk about Cuba as well, Gabrielle. If you look at the oil reserves coming via Venezuela, the quote is, according to AP, around 25 to 30% of Cuba's total oil, 30 to 40% are its own. But that's a lot of oil. And it's affected already the fact that the shipments of oil taken by the Trump administration, the US actions in December, has seen even more widespread blackouts. We're talking about a vulnerable potential country here, aren't we? A vulnerable government, given that Trump is now saying, you know, we effectively have control of the oil. How do you see this playing out?
It's a very important aspect of what's happening right now. Cuba and Venezuela have had an economic relationship where Venezuela has been shipping significant amounts of oil for, you know, well over a decade to Cuba at very reduced rates. Cuba has often sold that oil on the open market for hard currency that they use for all sorts of projects and state uses within Cuba. And in exchange, they have sent doctors, they have sent a lot of military and security advisors to Venezuela. And it's hard to know all the specific details, of course, but it's hard to imagine that that relationship will continue in any fashion whatsoever at this point. It's hard to imagine that the Trump administration and Marco Rubio in particular would allow Venezuela to continue sending oil in any fashion, but particularly at deeply discounted rates to Cuba. So that means that Cuba could be looking at a major immediate reduction in oil, and there could be a total severing of the sort of military and security relationship between Cuba and Venezuela. It's important to note that this relationship has deteriorated in recent years. Venezuela has been sending less oil than it used to before, partly related to its own economic crisis within Venezuela. It's not clear if Cuba's military presence in Venezuela has been reduced compared to what it was some years ago. But nonetheless, the capture of Maduro, the change in government within Venezuela is almost sure to have a major, major and drastic impact on the Cuba-Venezuela relationship. And we'll have to, you know, wait and see to know exactly how that plays out. But I think it's going to be very significant.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. First, a report on President Maduro's first appearance in the U.S. court and the death of at least 80 guards, including 32 from Cuba. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu praised Trump for a perfect operation in Venezuela. Colombian President Petro posted on X that Latin America must unite, while Marco Rubio issued warnings to Cuba. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro appeared in a federal court in Manhattan in New York City, where he pleaded not guilty to four criminal counts. If convicted, each count carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. One of them includes narco-terrorism. During his arraignment, Nicolas Maduro said, "I am not guilty. I am a prisoner of war. I am a decent man. I remain the president of my country." In the documents of court charges, prosecutors abandoned the Justice Department's prior claim that Maduro is the head of a drug cartel called Cartel de los Soles. In fact, no such organization exists. It was a Venezuelan term dating back to the 1990s, and it referred to public officials who were maybe involved in drugs. It no longer exists. Venezuela has been saying this all along, and of course now there's no proof and no evidence, and so those charges won't even be appearing in court against Maduro. Meanwhile, Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, has pleaded not guilty to three criminal counts that she faces. She appeared with bandages on her temple and forehead. Her lawyer says that she suffered significant injuries, including a possible rib fracture, as she was abducted by U.S. Army Delta Force team in a pre-dawn raid on the presidential palace in Caracas early on Saturday. Venezuelan officials say the U.S. assault caused at least 80 deaths, 32 Cubans serving as Maduro's personal security were killed during the assault. It's now being reported that the Cuban combatants inflicted wounds and possibly killed a number of U.S. troops in what has been described as a fierce firefight. All 32 Cubans who served as Maduro's security were killed. U.S. President Donald Trump could very well be hiding information on U.S. losses, insisting that his golden boys didn't suffer a scratch. Information is still coming up about the U.S. casualties in the illegal terrorist kidnapping of the Venezuelan president and the First Lady. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has congratulated President Trump on what he called a perfect operation in Venezuela. He spoke from a cabinet meeting in Israel, in Jerusalem. Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu said, "Regarding Venezuela, I want to express the entire government's support for the determined decision and action of the President of the United States to restore freedom and justice to that part of the world. I must say that across Latin America right now, we are seeing a transformation in several countries that are returning to the American axis, and, not surprisingly, also to a connection with the State of Israel. We welcome this. We congratulate President Trump on his decision, and we also salute the American military forces who carried out a perfect operation." That was Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, Netanyahu's praise for the United States and its assault on Venezuela came as Israeli forces occupying the Gaza Strip shot and killed at least three Palestinians in separate attacks over the weekend. Among the dead were a fisherman and a 15-year-old boy. Their deaths bring the number of Palestinians killed in Israel's genocidal ethnic cleansing machine to more than 70,000. In a series of lengthy posts on ex Colombian President Petro blasted President Trump, saying, "Stop slaughtering me and stop this nonsense." Petro called for Latin America to unite against the United States, saying that the region risks being treated as a servant and a slave. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has put the Cuban government on notice following the U.S. attack on Venezuela. Rubio spoke to NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. He was asked, "Is the Cuban government the Trump administration's next target, Mr. Secretary?" Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, "Well, the Cuban government is it's a huge problem, really, yeah. The Cuban government is a huge problem, first of all. So is that a yes?" Secretary of State Marco Rubio says, "Well, it's a problem for the people of Cuba, and I don't think people fully appreciate. I think they're in a lot of trouble. I'm going not to talk to you about what our future steps are going to be and our policies are going to be right now in this regard, but I don't think it's any mystery that we are not big fans of the Cuban regime."
Those reports are from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu most of the time, but there are no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm truly grateful for the donations. They are essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with NHK Japan. The Chinese and South Korean presidents held a summit in Beijing. The Interior Minister of Venezuela says that at least 100 people were killed in the kidnapping of President Maduro. Many countries spoke out at the United Nations against the abduction of a head of state and the threats to Greenland. The U.S.-based Eurasia Group said that this year's biggest risk is Trump dismantling checks on his power. Then a commentary on the power of Gen Z in the current world climate. NHK Japan.
Chinese President Xi Jinping met South Korean President Lee Jae-myung in Beijing on Monday. During the summit, she stressed that the two countries should uphold the results of World War II. China's foreign ministry stated that Xi said China and South Korea overcame Japan's militarism over 80 years ago by paying a huge sacrifice. He was also reported as saying the two nations should join hands to protect peace and stability in Northeast Asia. President Yi expressed his commitment to strengthening bilateral relations. He said the two countries should work together to bring peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Venezuela's interior minister says at least 100 people were killed and a similar number injured in last weekend's U.S. military operation in the country.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said on Sunday that no country can play the role of an international police or an international judge. He's not alone in criticizing the military operation.
There's no authority in international law to use military force to enter the territory of another nation to capture a de facto head of state or any other individual because they're facing criminal charges in your country.
But Trump suggested Venezuela may not be the only country subject to intervention. He says the U.S. needs Greenland, and he claimed the self-governing Danish territory is surrounded by Russian and Chinese ships. Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said in a statement on Sunday that it makes absolutely no sense to talk about the U.S. taking over Greenland. She pointed out that the Kingdom of Denmark is part of NATO and are covered by the alliance's security guarantee. Frederiksen urged Washington to stop threatening a close ally whose people clearly say they are not for sale. Countries across Asia are reacting to Maduro's capture. Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim says the forcible removal of a sitting head of government sets a dangerous precedent. Anwar posted a comment on social media. He says the operation was a clear violation of international law and an unlawful use of force against a sovereign state. He also called for the immediate release of Maduro and his wife. The Philippine Foreign Ministry said in a statement on Monday that while it acknowledges U.S. security considerations, it stresses the principles of international law, including the independence and sovereign equality of states. Thailand urged all parties involved to resolve the conflict peacefully with full respect for the UN Charter and international law, and to exercise the utmost restraint to avoid escalation. India called the developments in Venezuela a matter of deep concern and encouraged all sides to address issues peacefully through dialogue. Trump's recent actions have put a group of political forecasters on edge. They say a political revolution led by the president himself is this year's biggest risk. Officials at the U.S.-based Eurasia Group have released their annual Top Risks report. They say Trump is attempting to dismantle checks on his power, and they believe the United States is unwinding its own global order.
It is about making rule of law apply less. It is about having direct control over the administrative state, control over the party, and not have checks and balances. We would make a bet that the political revolution will eventually fail, not succeed. But there's a lot of damage that will be done, much of which will be permanent.
Trump didn't just take top spot. The forecasters say his so-called Don't Roll Doctrine is this year's third biggest risk. The report says Trump's military operation in Venezuela is the centerpiece of his new foreign policy. The forecasters say the doctrine does not just seek to limit China, Russia, and Iran in the Western Hemisphere. They say it also aims to assert American primacy through means including Trump's personal score settling.
People are fed up with corruption, inequality, and social injustice. I traveled to Nepal last year in the wake of the so-called Gen Z protests. The young Nepalese people I spoke with say they are still very politically active. Some are injured in last year's clashes. One of them told me if the next government fails to tackle corruption, he's ready to take to the streets again. Another expert I spoke with say we could see more this kind of thing happening elsewhere if young people feel they are being ignored.
These Gen Z protests that have only just begun, and 2026 is more than likely to see more of these, because these are not protests where people are angry with a certain crime that's taken place, or people are angry at simply prices of certain items at the grocery store going up. These are protests by youth that feel the political, social, and economic design of their nations is no longer working for them.
They are also concerned about growing unrest between nations. We saw several conflicts last year, the Thai-Cambodia border clashes I mentioned, as well as 4 days of fighting between India and Pakistan. With the situation in Gaza and Ukraine, and with what just happened in Venezuela, the threshold for violence could be lowering in Asia too.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be easily found at most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.